episode 577 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Chronology episode, and it's the final episode for now of the Secret War Chronology that we've been covering for quite a few months now. We started way back with the preludes for Marvel Superhero Secret Wars limited series, the 12-issue classic series from the early to mid-80s for Marvel. We moved on to the aftermath of that with quite a few Thing issues. And then, of course, immediately following that was Secret Wars 2 and all the tie-ins there. And lately, I've been talking about the unofficial Secret Wars 3 event, which took place over several issues of the Fantastic Four, as well as a Fantastic Four annual, really kind of exploring the nature of the Beyonder and his origins. And again, this is all subject to change with further appearances of the Beyonder later on. As it stands currently, the Beyonder is actually Cosmos. We found out he was essentially a cosmic cube whose creation sort of went awry, as it were, with some of what should have been the essence of that cube being shunted off and giving power to Owen Reese, the Molecule Man. So in the Fantastic Four Annual 23, we saw Cosmos kind of be educated under the tutelage of Cubic, another cosmic cube that was able to gain sentience at some point. And in today's episode, I'm going to be talking about the final installment of Secret Wars number 3. It's Fantastic Four number 351. It's from writer Len Kaminsky. We have pencils by Mark Bagley, some pretty early work from him. It's not quite as polished or as refined as his work on Spider-Man. It's not always recognizable as Mark Bagley. For those of you who are Ultimate Spider-Man fans who could recognize Bagley's artwork just about anywhere, this is a little less polished. We've got Dan Panosian on inks. We've got Bill Oakley on letters and Max Scheel on colors. So as I said, this picks up after the events of the Fantastic Four Annual 23 I talked about last time. And we have Cubic and Cosmos, and they have journeyed to Earth, what they consider to be the juncture of space-time. And there's various theories for why that is, just why is Earth so important. I mean, obviously, it's important for us. It's where we live and where these stories are coming from. But in the greater scheme of things, if such cosmic beings really were to exist in so many advanced species, like, why would Earth be so important? And Cosmos herself speculates that perhaps it's because the Earth is the current entry point for the nexus of all realities, which is a reference to the interdimensional gateway in the Florida Everglades that Man-Thing guards currently in the Marvel Universe when this takes place. Cubic himself suspects otherwise, and he begins to talk about some kind of fate or destiny, perhaps even tied into the Beyonders, those beings that have vast abilities and are even somewhat responsible for the existence of Cubic and Cosmos and really all cosmic cubes. And he suspects that perhaps the cosmic ray storm, which gave the Fantastic Four their superpowers, was not necessarily an accidental occurrence, but a manifestation of the very same cosmic force from which Cubic and Cosmos themselves were created. So they have decided to find out just what it is about these four beings that make them so special. Like, why were they chosen to be imbued with these powers? And in order to do that, they decide to surgically extract the essences of these four subjects from their three-dimensional continuum. And so we see on the page almost these crystalline versions of the Fantastic Four, which are representative of their essences. So Cubic kind of breaks it down and he says that they're going to remove from each of these essences that singular element of their psychogenetic programming, which is responsible for the choices they make and directs their actions. So from Mr. Fantastic, they extract superhuman intelligence. From Invisible Woman, they extract the vast capacity for compassion. From the Thing, they take tremendous courage, and from the Human Torch, innate aggressiveness. So interesting choices here. I think Reed is a no-brainer, and that obviously is what you would take from Reed. I don't know, compassion, I don't know that that's what I would take from Sue. I mean, it's certainly possible. Tenaciousness might be another. The Thing, I guess courage makes sense, but there's also a nobility there. And I don't know about aggressiveness from Human Torch. Recklessness, maybe? Love of life? But anyway, these are the attributes that make the most sense to Comiskey, who's writing the story. So I guess that's why they're all extracted. So for the next phase, phase three, Kubik creates this spheroid construct that's going to enable them to engage their subjects in a variety of typical conflict scenes and observe how the alterations affect their behavior. So each of the subjects is subliminally programmed to attempt to escape from the maze they're about to encounter. And it's going to test the abilities and their ability to cope with these obstacles that are placed before them. So they deposit the four members of the Fantastic Four within the maze, and we join the Thing first. He's walking through said maze, and he's confronted with a giant monster, and he thinks, how can I get out of this? He doesn't seem to want to fight, but he's cornered in a dead end of the maze, and he's trying to figure out what to do next. Meanwhile, Mr. Fantastic finds himself in the same maze, in a different part of the maze, and as he's traversing the maze, trying to figure out what to do, he runs across a photoelectric beam, and it triggers a trap, and he's locked in the darkness in this spherical ball, which has trapped him, and he's unable to break free. Meanwhile, the Human Torch is at the bottom of a large pit, and it doesn't seem to be too challenging for him. Apparently, all he needs to do to escape from the pit is fly straight up, right? So he attempts to flame on, and unfortunately, his powers seem to fizzle. So something's seriously wrong there, and he can't seem to activate his powers. And he slumps to the floor trying to figure out a plan B. How can he possibly get out of this deep pit that he's in with smooth walls? He has no hope of climbing out of them. Meanwhile, Sue finds herself in a maze as well, this more like a tube. And as she's walking around the maze, she notices some photoelectric cells on the side of the walls. And when she gets close, they fire a beam across. And as she looks a little more closely, she sees that there are hundreds of these gun ports, if you will, that fire these lasers. And she thinks, well, I'll just create some invisible force spheres and send them out to block the beams, and then I'll be able to pass them safely. But unfortunately, the beams slash right through her force bubbles as if they weren't even there. So how is she going to get past this trap if her invisible force field cannot protect her? And that is the trap that she finds herself in. So meanwhile, outside of the sphere, Kubik and Cosmos are observing, and Cosmos herself expresses disappointment with the performance of the subject so far and thinks that maybe they should reevaluate the parameters, maybe make it a little easier. But Kubik disagrees. He says, no, I believe the experiment is valid without any adjustment. Let's just keep watching. I think you're underestimating these beings, and these four in particular. So meanwhile, the Thing is creeping up very slowly to the monster that attacked him. And as he gets closer, he realizes that the only reason this monster attacked him was because it's a mother. And it's protecting its offspring, who are very small and vulnerable. And so the Thing approaches not in an aggressive manner, but a very docile manner, and befriends the mother. And as the mother now realizes that the Thing is of no danger to her baby, allows the thing to pass and continue along his way to find the way out of the maze. Meanwhile, Mr. Fantastic is still trying to use what strength he can to free himself from this trap. And he realizes that there's no way he'll be able to separate the halves of the sphere, but perhaps he can stretch himself thin enough that he can get through the containment seal from the two sides as they're pushed together. And he does manage to squeeze himself out, showing the tenacity that perhaps others didn't realize that he had up to that point. As the scene shifts to Johnny, he's thinking that there's no reason why his powers shouldn't be working. There's nothing there that's obviously inhibiting his flame. If there were some kind of gas in that atmosphere that would prevent him from flaming on, then he wouldn't be able to breathe normally either. So what he actually suspects is that he's not really being prevented from accessing his powers or using his flame ability. He's just being prevented from seeing that the flame is actually there. So he thinks that if he concentrates hard enough, he'll be able to overcome the illusion and realize that his flame is really there all along. And so as he meditates and concentrates, he does indeed not only activate his flame, but realize and he becomes able to observe that his powers are active after all. And he easily flies up and out of the pit that he is been trapped in. Meanwhile, the Invisible Woman is thinking about the beams that fire out the alien energy, and she thinks that her force field could handle any one or maybe two of them, but there's so many, she's just not sure how she's supposed to get past them. But she does realize that each of her shields that she generates may be able to prevent the beams from hitting her for, you know, maybe half a second. And so if she creates a series of very small shields and each of them only needs to exist for a split second, then maybe she can make it. And with a lot of courage on her part, she does just that and manages to get through the trap by creating that cascade shields in front of her, that cascade of shields. And as she moves quickly enough, she's able to get through the beams by showing this not only ingenuity, but a lot of courage. So meanwhile, the thing has managed to get through the maze and he's all the way at the top of the sphere and comments on what a weird looking sky it is. The other members of the Fantastic Four are there as well. And the thing remarks how great it is to see that they're all right, and wonders if anybody has any idea what's going on. Now, normally Reed would be the one to answer that question, but instead we get Johnny the Human Torch uncharacteristically saying, "Yes, I suspect we've been kidnapped by nearly omnipotent alien forces for study in some kind of alien test of character. In short, we've been used as lab rats." And Mr. Fantastic kind of takes on the thing's role here and says, "What? I say we find him and teach him a lesson." And the thing's like, "I don't know if that's such a good idea with them being omnipotent and all." And meanwhile, Sue is saying, "Johnny, what do you suggest? Is there anything we can do?" Johnny says, "I think so. But not only do you have the power to make visible things invisible, but you have the power to make invisible things visible. So if you're able to concentrate and use your powers to have them appear, then maybe we can confront them." Now, I've never heard of the Invisible Woman having this ability to make things that are invisible visible, but I'm just gonna go with it. And Mr. Fantastic, continuing his thing imitation, says, "Yeah, we'll confront them and show them that the Fantastic Four are not to be trifled with." So the Invisible Woman reaches out with her powers and she does feel something very large, almost if it's more than three dimensions. And when she concentrates, she's able to have Kubik and Cosmos appear. Kubik is very impressed and says that the subjects are capable of no end of surprises. And Cosmos, for her part, admits the error in her earlier judgment that they wouldn't be able to overcome the obstacles of the maze. And Kubik's response is, yeah, there's no shame in underestimating that. I think a lot of people underestimate humans in general, and these four members of humanity in particular. Kubik then apologizes for himself and Cosmos for the rude treatment and says that everything they've done has only been with the noblest of intentions, and they have the Fantastic Four has Kubik and Cosmos's incalculable gratitude. So the two cosmic beings talk it over, with Cosmos being impressed by what exceptional beings the Fantastic Four are, and she's beginning to have an understanding of why the powers that be of the universe have such an unusual interest in humans. And Cosmos remarks that it's true that their versatility is almost without limit. You know, they removed the primary characteristic of each of the members. And basically what happened is previously unsuspected secondary traits blossom to fill the void of the things that were missing. So the thing usually, you know, more on the brutish side of things, was able to show a capacity for compassion. The invisible woman displayed courage far beyond her usual inclination for courage in taking the risk of running through that laser field. Mr. Fantastic showed a core of aggressiveness, which allowed him to persevere in escaping from the sphere, which hadn't previously been evident, been kind of sublimated by his intellectual pursuits. And of course, the happy-go-lucky, always aggressive Human Torch demonstrated a powerful intellect, which his aggressive nature normally leaves him without the patience to use. He's normally a shoot first, ask questions later kind of guy. And once that aspect was taken away, he found within himself the patience to reason his way out of a problem. So, Kubik then returns the Fantastic Four to their point of origin, saying that they'll only recall this encounter as a dream that was that has allowed them to achieve greater self-knowledge, and feels that it's the least they can do for putting them through these tests. So Kubik does also mention that their mastery of the environment shelters them from the opportunity to develop as individuals. But he does appreciate that these beings, such as humans, have the capacity to evolve and grow, and he actually envies them that. So Cosmos and Kubik then take their leave, saying our study here is done, but there are further wonders to be discovered in the vastness of the universe, though he suspects none of them greater than the lesson learned today, and the issue ends. So other than the fact Cosmos used to be the Beyonder, I don't really see how this ties into Secret Wars 3, and I'm not really sure why it's here, again, other than it's continuing the story of the Beyonder. So you can almost think of it as not just a Secret Wars chronology, but a Beyonder's chronology, because when you think about what we've done so far, the issues that we've talked about from the preludes of Marvel Superhero Secret Wars, the first series where a lot of times it was that power of the Beyonder being sensed by machines that Mr. Fantastic was using, or Bruce Banner was using, or Spider-Man's spider sense detecting the powerfulness of the Beyonder, or Professor X sensing that presence and how powerful it was. It's really Beyonder, 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 right? In through the 12-issue miniseries where obviously the Beyonder plays a key role as we get the story of our heroes and villains fighting against each other. And then the story of the Thing that maybe didn't have the Beyonder so much as a overt character, but had him and the residual energies of him allowing the Thing to create kind of a self-fulfilling world for himself that was giving him what he never realized he always wanted. on into Secret Wars 2, which is really where you can think of this as the story of the Beyonder, as he's the main character, although not particularly likable. I will say that this unofficial Secret Wars 3 story at least has flipped the script on that and allowed the Beyonder to be a little bit more of an interesting character. Maybe it's because we suspect what his origins are. And the reason I say suspect is because I believe it's been changed since this Secret Wars 3 story has happened. But I'm sure we'll get to that in a future Marvel chronology when we come back to the Secret War chronology. So I'm glad to be done with this for a while. I think having talked about the Beyonder for so long, it's definitely time to move on. And as I mentioned, the next part of the Secret War reading order, or the Beyonder reading order, if you will, is Annihilation. And I think that based on the fact that Thanos himself is a really integral part of that Annihilation series, and I don't just want to read the parts of the Annihilation event and crossover that just deal with the Beyonder. I kind of want to have a good understanding of all of it. Plus, I feel it's a good time to switch gears and get away from the Secret War / Beyonder chronology for now. We're going to move on into a definitive Thanos reading order, and I found this reading order at a site called CrushingCrisis.com. It's crushing with a C, but crisis is spelled with a K. And it's got a really great reading order, starting with the Thanos Rising miniseries from 2013, then going into Classic Thanos, which are Thanos stories from 1973 to 1977. Then he's off the board for quite a while. Actually, I think it would surprise people just how long it went between Thanos showing up in things like Captain Marvel and Adam Warlock and Death of Captain Marvel and even Avengers. He doesn't show up again until the Infinity Trilogy, which was very popular in the 90s. And then we've got the After Infinity Trilogy, the Infinity Abyss, the Annihilation Saga, as I mentioned, Thanos Returns and the New Infinity Saga, Jonathan Hickman's Avengers, and then the all-new, all-different Marvel, which brings us up to present time. So there's a lot to unpack here, but it all starts with the 2013 miniseries by Jason Aaron with painterly pencils from Simone Bianchi, which explores the history of the Mad Titan starting in his childhood. And I remember reading the first couple issues of this series when it came out. I don't think I ever finished it, so I'm really looking forward to checking it out. So again, this all comes from the CrushingCrisis.com website, and I'll certainly put a link in the show notes so that you can go and check out the Thanos reading order and see what we're going to be covering over the next, I don't know, maybe a year or so of the Marvel chronology. We'll see how long we stick with the Thanos chronology before it's time to switch up to something else. So really excited to talk about a character that is such a huge part of the Marvel universe and the Marvel cinematic universe right now. So I think a lot of you are going to enjoy it, especially when we get into that classic stuff from about 1968 and Thanos's first appearance in Iron Man 55 up through the death of Captain Marvel, which was 1982. So it should be a whole heck of a lot of fun. So again, Thanos Rising number one will be next week's Marvel chronology on Saturday. Hope you join us for that. Meanwhile, I want to thank everybody for joining me today. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource, or do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.